Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Did the early Christians believe their myths? Like most ancient and modern people, early Christians made efforts to present their myths in the most believable ways. In this eye-opening work, M. David Litva explores how and why what later became the four canonical Gospels take on historical cast that remains vitally important for many Christians today, offering an in-depth comparison with other Greco-Roman stories that have been shaped to seem like history. Litva shows how the evangelists responded to the pressures of Greco-Roman literary culture by using well-known historiographical tropes, such as the mention of famous rulers and kings, geographical notices, the introduction of eyewitnesses, vivid presentation, alternative reports, and so on. In this way, the evangelists deliberately shaped myths about Jesus into historical discourse to maximize their believability for ancient audiences. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Biblical Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jonathan Wright, your host. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. M. David Litva about his new book, How the Gospels Became History, Jesus and Mediterranean Myths. Dr. Litva is a scholar of ancient Mediterranean religions and research fellow at the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. His most recent books include Desiring Divinity, Self-Deification in Ancient Jewish and Christian Mythmaking, and Hermetica II, The Excerpts of Stobaeus, Papyrus Fragments, and Ancient Testimonies. Dr. Litva, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself and how you became interested in studying the Bible and its contemporary Greco-Roman literature.
Well, I'd be glad to. I'm currently research fellow at the Institute for Critical Religion and Critical Inquiry, which is a division of the Australian Catholic University, or ACU, in Melbourne, Australia. And this is a very dynamic place to do research in early Christianity. And I have six or seven colleagues in early Christianity. And we all complement each other's interests and experiences. How I got interested in this topic, really since I was a child, I've had an interest in strange stories regarding divine persons, heroes, gods, demons, daimones, angels. And two of the greatest repositories of such stories were the biblical documents and what goes under the name of Greco-Roman mythology, which is just the cultural lore of the ancient Mediterranean. And I can remember reading through as a kid the whole Bible and getting, remember, a second grade level handbook of Greek mythology filled with all sorts of interesting pictures and captions and stories that really fired my imagination. And when I entered divinity school, I became very interested in heroes, what we might think of as superheroes today, human beings who upgrade into gods or beings of various grades of divinity, which became a major research niche for me early in my career. And the buzzword here is deification. Some people prefer theosis. And during my PhD training at the University of Virginia, I always had one foot in classical studies and the other in religious studies. And at least at the time I was there, I noticed that the departments really quite surprisingly rarely interacted. The networks were pretty loose or non-existent. And of course, the departments were in different buildings, but more importantly, they had built up different intellectual traditions and methodologies and ways of thinking and doing research. Of course, classics has always been very philologically based, focusing on the learning of languages. And religious studies today seems to have increasingly moved away from that and let its language requirements go. But there are other differences in the kind of training that is received both in classics and religious studies. But it just so turned out that even though I have my degree in religious studies, my first job was in the UVA classics department. And from there, I went on to teach Greek and Roman mythology at the College of William and Mary and their beautiful campus. And I organized my classes, since I was kind of a hybrid centaur, I organized my classes looking at both what we might think of as biblical mythology and Greek mythology, and on the principle of comparing the stories and stories that had rarely been compared, or at least much of the comparisons had kind of that had first been done in the 19th and early 20th century weren't being done anymore. And I often wondered why. So I committed myself over the course of many years to helping to increase the conversation between classics and religious studies. And I guess you could call this book the fruit of that research.
Mm. Wow, what an interesting story. And I'm so glad it has shaped where you are today. And so let's talk about this book then. What inspired you to write this work?
Well, the practical reason I've already gotten into, it was to increase the interaction between experts in classical mythology and biblical studies. In PhD programs in biblical or religious studies or early Christianity today, there are no requirements to learn the cultural lore of Greek and Romans, that is classical mythology. And so a lot of those stories and heritage is more or less unknown by scholars of the New Testament, even though that was the mass media of the time when the early Christian documents were being written. And so I really wanted to go back and renew a topic that had been of interest in the early 20th century, Rudolf Bultmann being a major player, but his program of demythologization was basically a theological program that didn't stand the test of time for a variety of reasons. And since then, the study of myth and biblical studies has somewhat grown distant. And my attempt here is to renew that. But I guess on a more personal or deeper level, I was always interested in the question of why historicity was valued as the rhetoric of truth in Western culture. You know, media today still appeals to people. Documentaries and movies and programs of all sorts still catches people by the caption based on a true story. People are very attracted to history and to history, the History Channel and various other programming which investigates the real truth, so to speak, behind ancient events. And archaeology is exploded in the 20th century to kind of historically prove many of the biblical events. And in a sense, if one could find Noah's Ark, one could prove the story was correct. And you know, that's maybe a somewhat crude example, although of course attempts to find the Ark continue. But on a certain more subtle level, that way of thinking really continues to pervade our society and biblical studies, that if it's not historical, it's not true. And a lot of Christian apologists use the discourse of historicity to shore up the truth of what they're saying, and even present so-called historical facts as the main evidence for the truth of their religion. And I always was curious about this wanted to learn, brush up, as it were, on a bit of the theoretical background of, you know, what is history anyway? And why do we worship this goddess called history and think that she holds the secret of truth? And why, in my own field of biblical studies, is so much intellectual energy expended on the so-called historical Jesus? This historical Jesus has always struck me as the supreme myth of our own field. What are we looking for when we're searching for the historical Jesus? On one level, we want to, I think, have a sense that these stories are on some level true. We might not believe every detail, but we want to reassure ourselves that there is a historical basis, and we're talking about so-called real events. Because if they're not real, then the truth value of the events is threatened. So I don't have a problem, I just want to be clear, with the historical Jesus or studying the historical Jesus. All of that is well and good. My question is, why? Why is it so important for us to get the facts right, especially when what we call facts really are just sort of inner scholarly agreements about what might have happened or what is probable, which are, of course, based on human structures of plausibility. What we've been trained or socialized to believe is actually possible, and constructions based on those assumptions about what is plausible and rewoven into narratives that apparently we can believe today, narratives that end up on the History Channel and for various reasons inspire Christians, perhaps many others, to believe in the truth of their religion. I'm interested in why that process occurs. And so one could think of this study as having that underlying question. What do we mean by history? And why do we think that it is so connected to truth?
Right. Yeah. And so in that discussion and in your work, you identify the genre historia. And I'd love if you could kind of talk about what it is and how it relates to the Gospels.
So when a young child would go to what the equivalent of our elementary education, our elementary school, when that child would go to grammar school, they would learn about three kinds of stories. And these are basically very broad, generic classifications. And one kind of story taught in grammar school in the ancient Mediterranean was called historia. And historia was generally defined as a kind of story that is supposed to relate events that occurred in the past. And it's often said that the Greeks invented historia. Herodotus, Thucydides, these giants gave us what eventually became our own genre of history. But historia in the ancient sense is that kind of story that is supposed to or is assumed to relate events that occurred in the past. And ancient grammarians distinguished this kind of story from what they called mythos, which is a kind of story that relates events that either people thought did not happen or could not have happened. And for instance, the story of the horse Pegasus arising from the blood of the Gorgon Medusa. That wasn't even believable to the ancients. I mean, so that would be taken as a mythos. And there was, interestingly, an intermediate category called plasma, which sometimes translated fiction. And this story, kind of story, relates events that could have happened, but did not happen. And here we might think of the stories that appear in novels or historical novels. And we should keep in mind that the novel was also invented by Greek culture in this very era in which the Gospels arose as well. And what's interesting is these three kinds of story, many ancient authors tended to blend plasma and mythos together so that it wasn't really clear what those boundaries were. And there developed a very common rhetoric in the ancient world of mythos versus historia. That is, if one author wanted to accuse another author of not speaking the truth, and this often happened among so-called historians, they could say that, hey, you're talking about mythos or mythoi in the plural, and I'm trying to do historia. Which is a way, became a way, and it was adopted in the pastoral epistles, of trying to denigrate the truth value of somebody else's story, that, well, you didn't like because that story in some way undermined your identity, or you found it implausible, or it just sounded crazy, or was told to children. And so you could denigrate that kind of story by calling it a mythos. And this very ancient binary between mythos and historia gave birth to, and through many various paths and over many centuries, to our own binary of myth versus history. What the issue is here, though, is often myth and whether we're talking about the ancient mythos and historia or the modern myth and history, these typically aren't actually binaries, except in a rhetorical sense. They're more like ideal types that in reality are constantly being negotiated, because all of us, depending upon our identities, depending upon where we're coming from, what communities we belong to, what religious communities groups we belong to, we're constantly negotiating what is plausible, what is possible, what is probable, and that is constantly being culturally negotiated. And culturally, we're growing up and being socialized to believe that certain things are plausible and probable. And in the ancient world, there was an interesting phenomena, literary phenomena, in the period that the Gospels were written, that ancient historians, people who identified themselves as historians, would look back at what we call myth or classical mythology and be involved in making those stories look as much like history as possible. Because you have to think that these stories, again, what we call classical mythology, were the cultural heritage of the ancient Greeks. And so stories that we would call myth today were, to the ancients, very much history. You know, a key example here is the Trojan War. A lot of students in high school and college will read Homer's two epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, as part of their course in classical mythology. Well, of course, to the ancient Greeks, this wasn't mythology in any straight sense. They all believed that the Trojan War happened, that it was true, that there was a man called Achilles, that there was a war between Asia and Europe, and there was a man called Agamemnon, and all of that was true. But it had been, they thought, spiced up by poetic diction, and Homer, whoever he was or whatever he represented, had, in a sense, added a bunch of details that had a kind of fantastical flavor. So a key example is Achilles's mother happened to be a sea goddess, what we might think of as a mermaid. And, you know, that's not only unbelievable to us today, that was actually unbelievable to the cultural elite during the late first century. And so they were always in the business of trying to make their cultural lore look like history and look more and more like history. And so this was a literary phenomena that was going on during the time that the Gospels were written. And based on this phenomena, I've presented a new category called mythic historiography. And this kind of historiography basically looks at fantastical tales and tries to put them into historiographical form. So they'll say that, oh, for instance, yes, Theseus, everybody knows Theseus, he fought the Minotaur. Actually, this Minotaur wasn't a guy with a bull's head, because that's just sort of silly, but it was actually a Cretan general or a general on the Isle of Crete, and he was working for Minos, and he was a really nasty kind of a guy, and Theseus beat him, and in this underground dungeon called the Labyrinth, which had a bunch of doors and corridors, so it began to be thought of as a gigantic maze, and the tale was spiced up, and it was brought back into history by using certain historiographical tropes to bring it back into the realm of plausibility, at least for someone, an educated Greek person. So to sum up, this historia, getting back to your main question, this movement of mythos to historia and trying to make fantastical tales look historical is what I'm calling mythic historiography. And that is the genre in which I'm trying to conceptualize, perhaps reconceptualize, the Gospels as not just historiography, but mythic historiography. That is, fantastical tales written in historiographical form.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so in your book, you argue that while the Gospels and Greek lore don't share a causative relationship, but they do share what you call dynamic cultural interaction. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk about how were the Gospels influenced by Greco-Roman literature?
Well, I kind of set up my comparisons by being in dialogue with two other groups of people who compare. And one of those groups are called the Jesus mythicists, those folks who, for a variety of reasons, think that Jesus did not in fact exist as a historical person, or that he did, but that nothing of what was written about him actually relates to that historical individual. These mythicists will use Greco-Roman mythology, Greco-Roman cultural lore. In fact, they'll use any kind of cultural lore that they can get their hands on to attempt to show that the stories of the Gospels essentially aren't true. And so you can think of them as kind of the reverse of an evangelical or fundamentalist who would be tempted to say, hey, look it over here. These things are historical. They have historicity. Ergo, they are true. And what the mythicist is trying to do with that same philosophy about the relation of historicity and truth, they're trying to say, hey, look it over here. These stories are just based on myths, so ergo, they're not historical. Ergo, they're not true. Now, that I deal with in chapter one of the book. I'm going to leave that aside for the moment and talk about the second group that I try to address when I talk about dynamic cultural interaction. And that group is a current group in the field of biblical studies called the mimesis critics, or who call themselves that. The major figure here is Dennis R. MacDonald, has written a number of works and has produced a kind of comparative method that has been widely and I think justly criticized. But the main point of it is to make fairly rigid and direct genetic connections between gospel stories and Homer, or the Homeric writings, and recently writings from Euripides and some of the other greats. And the whole purpose of this kind of comparison is to sort of connect the dots between, to show how gospel stories are constructed out of these well-known cultural stories, mostly from Homer. And when I talk about dynamic cultural interaction, I'm essentially saying to folks that I don't much care for that kind of comparison that is mainly focused on making genetic connections between literature. Of course, that did happen in the ancient world. No one is saying that didn't happen. Virgil, of course, had his Homer open when he was writing the Aeneid. But that kind of fairly simplistic attempt to make genetic connections between individual documents only tells maybe a small percentage of what was really going on when we're talking about early Christian interaction with their own cultural lore in the Hellenistic world, in the Eastern Mediterranean. They would have had access to what we think of as Greek cultural lore through all sorts of media. They would have seen plays. They would have gone to the arena where certain, unfortunately, in executions, certain mythological stories were played out. They would have seen it on the megalithic artwork in some of the major cities in the Eastern Mediterranean, some of which still survives. The sculpture, hundreds, thousands of pieces of sculpture which survived and now exist in museums. They would have heard of Greek cultural lore through word of mouth, of course, children's fairy tales, political speeches, poetry recitations, all sorts of ways. And there would have been networks, very advanced in some cases, networks of people connected and transmitting that cultural information. And in some cases, there being a cascade effect where everybody knows a certain story, whether and one of those people can be, you know, in the far reaches of Western Spain, and the other person can be in Syria, and they know the same story. And one of the reasons they did so is for elites, the educational system was based often on rhetorical set pieces, which were in turn often based on what we would call mythological stories. And the students would be drummed with these stories at an early age so that they would be permanently etched in their memory, and they would be expected to expand on these stories and to write speeches based on these stories and to impersonate the characters in these stories. And so when you looked at the cultural knowledge of what we call Greco-Roman mythology, the reason why it's so widespread and surprisingly uniform is because people are in constant dynamic cultural interaction and networked through the educational system to learn these stories. I guess the analogy today, if you could think of the Marvel franchise or the DC Comics franchise, I mean, everybody today, even if you have zero interest in superheroes, knows who Batman is, and Superman, and Spider-Man, and they, even if they haven't seen the movies, unfortunately, they might still have a lot of cultural information, and might be able to pick that up through various media. And of course, now we have all different sorts of social media. And they might even, you know, have a basic knowledge of, you know, how Spider-Man became Spider-Man, or that Superman is how Superman became Superman, and that he's an alien, and so on and so forth. They might have picked this up without really ever having picked up a comic book. The cultural information has basically bled into the culture and through various networks. And that's one way of thinking about dynamic cultural interaction in the ancient world when we think about how deeply the knowledge of mythology, what we call mythology, was in the ancient Mediterranean.
Mm. Yeah, no, that is very helpful. So then you spend most of the book identifying historiographical tropes in Greco-Roman stories, such as, you know, the incarnation of divinity, genealogies, geographical notices, dreams, the introduction of eyewitnesses, etc. And you show how the Gospels use similar literary tools. Why do you think we find these similarities in the Gospels?
Well, here it's important to distinguish the historiographical tropes from the content of the mythic historiographies. I sort of follow the life of Jesus, and I talk about, as you mentioned, incarnation, genealogy, dream narratives, resurrection narratives. I talk about the Magi. I talk about miracles. I talk about ascension stories and disappearance stories, kind of following the life of Jesus. Those are the contents of the stories. But the historiographical tropes are a bit different. They're the techniques that the gospel writers and, among other historians, used to make their stories seem as historiographical as possible. One of them you mentioned, the geographical notices. If you want to make your story sound historiographical, you'll mention well-known places. You know, I was here at the Eiffel Tower or something like that, or I was at the Empire State Building or the Statue of Liberty at a certain city, a well-known city, and so on and so forth. There are at least nine other tropes I discuss, one of them being the mention of well-known persons, typically rulers, that locate us in space and time. So in the Gospel, According to Luke, for instance, you have the mention of Caesar Augustus, and everybody knows Caesar Augustus. And he even goes into a bit more detail. He says, well, Jesus was born during the governorship of Quirinius, and he was governor of Syria at the time. And then everybody's like, oh, okay, well, you've done your homework. Nice job. I mean, we must be talking about a historical event. This is a more or less a rhetorical appeal, because if modern dating is correct, the author of this gospel is about a decade off, and that Quirinius wasn't governor at the time. But the very fact that he was named is very significant and helps locate a person in space and time. Another very broad historiographical trope is objectification, which simply means describing individually experienced phenomena as if they were fully knowable and observable by others. So if you take, for instance, the resurrection stories, a lot of scholarship and thinking about these is that these were based on visions of Jesus coming back from the dead, and there was a whole field looking at can we reconstruct these early Christian experiences of seeing the resurrected Jesus, and so on and so forth. But really, this, I take this not not in that way at all. I take this as basically a literary technique where the gospel writers are portraying what must have been subjective experiences, or what we think of as subjective experiences, and presenting them as if they were widely perceived and almost scientifically known events, with multiple witnesses, you know, 12 witnesses, 500 witnesses, that everybody could see, that everybody could feel, taste, and touch. That's objectification. Another trope is just simply straightforward matter-of-fact presentation. You know, if I say that, you know, today I got up, I turned off my alarm clock, I went and had eggs for breakfast, then I got on the train and I walked to work, and then I took a walk by the pond and I started walking on the pond, then I got lunch, and then I got some dinner. Well, the fact that I walked on the pond, I mean, I said it just like I said everything else. That very matter-of-fact presentation of even unusual or impossible events is a way, is actually a rhetorical technique to kind of blend that in to with other commonly plausible kind of events. If you can mix in an implausible with a plausible, with a whole network of plausible events, and speak of it as a fact, you can increase the plausibility effect. Another way of doing this is vivid presentation. You know, a narrative may be completely untrue, but if it's full of details and even random circumstantial details, like I describe exactly what toothpaste I used this morning, and I describe the feel of it and the feeling of effervescence in my mouth. I mean, the reality is I might or might not have brushed my teeth, but if I can describe it vividly, it gives you a sense that, oh, okay, he's describing something that he wants me to believe that actually happened. Another technique is the claim to accuracy, and often this is by an appeal to eyewitnesses. The trouble with eyewitnesses in a literary narrative is that it's sometimes the case when you look back at ancient Mediterranean literature, and you look at these eyewitnesses, and scholars have realized, and even the ancients have realized, that the eyewitnesses themselves are part of the story. That is, they have been constructed in the narrative. They have no independent existence, but something has happened in the narrative, and then an eyewitness has been appealed to. But the eyewitness is also a literary artifact, and this is a very special technique that the ancients, and I assume modern novelists use this technique all the time too, to increase the reality effect of the story. Okay, another claim to accuracy is you can stage skepticism among the characters in the story. So again, to use a gospel example here, in the resurrection account in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus appears very openly and is talking. The resurrected Jesus is talking to the disciples on a mountain, and It says very clearly that some were just looking at Jesus straight in his eye, looking at his body as he was talking, and they doubted. And apparently, we are together, they doubted the fact of the resurrection. But here he was. And so if you can stage skepticism among the characters in the story, you can kind of get a sense that, well, you know, the reader might be a little bit skeptical that a guy rose from the dead, but if the characters in the story are also skeptical and their skepticism is looks stupid or is somehow overcome, as in the case of doubting Thomas, where first of all, he doesn't believe, but when he gets to put his finger in Jesus' side, well, then everything's okay, right? So that staging of skepticism is another way that a literary artist will use to increase the plausibility of their story. We also have stated links of causation to give the impression that we're talking about real events. Again, the author of the Gospel of Matthew uses an alternative report. He says, you know, the soldiers were overpowered when Jesus was resurrected. An angel came, opened the tomb, and they were like dead men. And they finally, after the resurrection occurred, sort of woke back up, got their act together, and dragged themselves up to the high priest and said that the body was taken. And the high priests say, hey, listen, we'll just say that you fell asleep and that the disciples came and stole the body. And this story, says the author of the Gospel of Matthew, was still current. And in fact, it has various manifestations in reception history. But the point here is that this story is put as a link to say, hey, the reason why there's this story that the disciples stole the body is because this earlier case where the soldiers actually lied to the high priest and the high priest said, well, you should continue to spread this lie, as it were, that the disciples stole the body. So there's in the narrative itself, there's a kind of alternative report that the disciples stole the body, but there's an explanation for that alternative report which shows that it's a lie. So that's another way to increase plausibility. And finally, narratives can use the historiographical trope of inventing traces of the past, such as material artifacts said to survive in the present. And I use the example of tomb tokens. People resurrected in the ancient world, you know, there's this constant criticism of in the modern period that, well, hey, maybe the disciples went to the wrong tomb. You know, I mean, maybe it was a simple mistake because honestly, they didn't really take a good look. And it was the women and so on and so forth who were taking care of the burial, yada, yada, yada. But the Gospels are very clear that no, there is actually tokens that make sure that this is the right tomb. And the Gospel of John says that there was a headcloth which was carefully folded and which showed that that was actually Jesus' tomb. And you find this in other stories too, where they'll say things like Alcmena, the mother of Heracles, she was also resurrected. She exited the tomb somehow, even though it was sealed. And we have some jewelry from her or certain pots that we can identify and some accounts even an inscription. And these invented traces are kind of interesting because you'll find things that say like, oh, and these artifacts still exist, but they're often in distant or inaccessible places like the piece of the true cross. The cross exists, but it exists as a relic in some very obscure church or something like that. And you would have to take a pilgrimage to go actually verify that. This is another historiographical trope that is used throughout the Gospels. So just to be clear, when the reader is going through the book, they're going to be reading about incarnation and genealogy and Jesus divinely conceived and miracles and so on and so forth. And I'm going to be continually comparing these stories with other Greek and Roman stories to show that the same, not exactly the same content, but the same historiographical tropes are being used to prove that these stories are historical or that they be taken as history. And this is the general technique of the genre that I'm introducing. That is the kinds of the kind of technique which is called or which I'm calling as mythic historiography.
Exactly. Yeah, well, thank you for doing that. I appreciate those comparisons, and it's very thought-provoking. So ultimately, you suggest that the Gospels, as you've said before, can be classified as mythic historiography. How do you see this finding impact or to change Gospel scholarship?
Well, you know, on a practical level, I'm hoping that it will reopen conversation of interpreting biblical stories and or between biblical scholars and experts in classical mythology. And I'm hoping it will encourage biblical scholars and people training for PhDs to immerse themselves in the common Greco-Roman lore of the day and to go ahead and take courses in classical mythology and maybe even learn some of the tools of myth theory. And here I can heartily recommend the book Theorizing Myth by Bruce Lincoln. But of course, there's an endless literature about interpreting myth both in the ancient and modern world. And the fact that the Gospels are now commonly classified as biographies is in fact no hindrance to also thinking of them as myth. And if we think of the Gospels as mythic historiography, then we can both combine and reopen the lines of conversation between classics and biblical studies. But I guess more importantly, I'm attempting, what I want to change, I guess, is to put it bluntly, to sever the final tie between biblical studies and a kind of apologetics, the apologetical attempt to shore up Christian truth by reading it and studying it and, in effect, making it history. And by assuming that the concept of historicity has a connection, an inherent connection to the truth of the narrative. I'm trying to advocate, and I do this mostly in the last chapter, that gospel truth, whatever it is, can't make itself dependent on historicity, because historicity it's very much a human concept and a human construction. History itself, in the sense of narratives relating past events, is very much a human construction, very much something that scholars constantly debate, and no one agrees on, particularly about the historical Jesus. Anyone familiar with this literature will see endless rancor and debate. So one wouldn't really want to base religious truth on a human construction. And that's what I really advocate, that question your presuppositions. If your presuppositions are that historicity is going to shore up the truth of your religious belief, but that's a philosophical issue that is a real problem and is based on your conditioning in Western culture. And you ought to think seriously about how you think about truth. In my field, there's a vast interest in biblical history, and I've already mentioned the attempt to co-opt archaeology, mostly in the mid 20th century, but continuing today, archaeology is co-opted to support the biblical narrative. I have to say, all the interest in biblical history, the history behind the Bible since the Enlightenment, has, in my view, a kind of theological undercurrent. History is viewed as the standard and measure of truth because it gives us supposed access to what really happened or what is thought to have really happened. And so, if a religion can use this discourse can use the rhetoric of history and present its own sacred documents as history, it can also present itself as true to people of modern sensibilities. And that's why I think it's often celebrated that Jesus does appear on the History Channel. And well, he should, but that's not necessarily a guarantee of the gospel truth. And that has to be realized, that that involves a philosophical presupposition that has to be questioned in modern times, especially because Christian apologists have the unfortunate habit of denigrating other religions, which they claim aren't based on historical facts, never having questioned the construction of those facts or having imagined that those facts are simply their own human constructions. What they end up doing is presenting a very highly ethnocentric discourse, which has been prevalent in the West, where Westerners tend to perceive truth in historical form and therefore present their true facts about reality and their stories as history in order to shore up the cultural value of their own heritage. And this is not only, again, this is not only a problem for religious communities. This is something that Westerners, and I'm very much a part of this Western culture, this is something that we have done for centuries. And we need to question that kind of thought process.
Right. Absolutely. And so, you know, as you wrote this book, I'm sure it involved, a lot of time, a lot of late nights, a lot of cups of coffee. As you wrote this work, how did you envision readers kind of walking away from your book? Like, how would you like to see just kind of the general reader changed because of your work?
Well, again, on a practical level, I would love for biblical scholars, secular folks, interested laypersons, people interested in superheroes, to get interested also in Greek and Roman mythology as part of our cultural heritage, as a great creative source for inspiration, for how we think of religious truth and religious narratives, and for our own cultural narratives that of late involve a lot of superheroes and transformations and resurrections of sorts. And I'd also like PhD students and those working in biblical studies, entering biblical studies, to learn more of the theoretical models for reading mythology and to get interested in that and to feel the need for that, because there is a true need, and we need to, in a way, renew our interest, the very perennial interest between mythology and biblical studies. And of course, on a more deeper level, I want people to walk away changed by having simply broader questions of how gospel narratives arose as literature. We've gotten into the rut, I think, of assuming very simplistically that these narratives are history, and therefore we can compare the history of the Gospels with the history of other Greco-Roman narratives. But we haven't done the real intellectual work of asking, what are these narratives in the first place? What is intended by these narratives? They're certainly not history books. The Gospels are certainly not history books. They can be used with pain, labor, sweat, sometimes blood, to find out who the so-called historical Jesus is. But in the end, that's a construction. And so the broader question here is, using this kind of literature, what can and can we not know about Jesus? Because people have actually killed over this issue. And it's important to know the limits of knowledge here based on the literature that we have. And finally, I'd love for people to be changed in thinking more seriously always about how to do comparison in an in-depth way. And I hope sincerely that I've been a model for that and showing that we need to go beyond superficial comparisons, which in the end just annoy people, annoy scholars who are trying to do serious work, and get other people real riled up for no reason. I've only provided a sort of foretaste of in-depth comparison, and I'm sure that others can go deeper, and that's what excites me, that the methods that I use in the book can be improved, and others can find more if they do the comparisons with a real thoughtful theoretical framework and careful method. There's much work to be done here.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is exciting to see where it will head next. And so speaking of the future, what projects are you working on next before you go? Would you mind sharing with our audience?
Sure. I've just finished a book on ancient figures who become angels or angel-like beings called daimones in the ancient world. Daimones being different than demons, of course, mediating figures who have superhuman powers, but very human emotions. And this is another comparative study looking at how early Christian discourse of what I'm calling angelification interacted with, again, the broadly Greco-Roman and more specifically Platonic discourses about becoming what the ancients called a daimon, or a superhuman being, both in this life and the next. That project is actually finished. I'm seeking for a publisher. The current writing project that I'm writing on and excited right now is, I have the somewhat of a background in what's called Gnostic or Nag Hammadi studies, and I'm just fascinated on how and why some early Christian groups came to conceive of the creator of this world, the Jewish deity, as an evil being. And we see this idea, which is quite unthinkable, I think, to Christians today, but springing up seemingly independently among a variety of Christian groups, none of them, of course, who, in a sense, became part of what we know today as early Catholicism, but a variety of groups who thought of the creator of this world as an evil being and thought that that is in fact what their Bibles said. I'm looking at native Egyptian traditions that portrayed the Jewish creator Yahweh as a form of Seth, a god of evil and chaos. But I'm also looking at the exegesis, that is the interpretation, early Christian interpretation of Paul, mainly, John, the Gospel of John, and the Hebrew Bible, to see why certain Christians thought, based on the Bible, that the character of the Creator was evil. And I see this, and seeing this character, not based on, say, their own subjective experience, but as rooted in the biblical texts and stories themselves. That's an idea that is truly fascinating, perhaps even frightening, but certainly interesting and worth exploration.
Right. Well, that sounds very exciting. So, Dr. Litva, thank you so much for donating your time.
Thank you.
I just want to reiterate that, you know, this is a very thought-provoking and stimulating work that I think all students of gospel studies will want to be familiar with. For our listeners, you've been listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Again, I'm Jonathan Wright, your host. And until next time, take up and read.